7 billion people.
Oh, that's Bill Gates there. And Dr. Fauci from the US, rounding off that discussion we had earlier this week with the Hatters, the whole authority to account journalists from the Northwest. That's Henry Widdows and Ben Butler. The points raised there, Martin, really are all to do with the way the profession is changing. Apparently, they're even getting CGI presenters on Chinese television.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, the print media have obviously crashed completely over recent years. And, you know...
So this is all an economic thing? No.
Well, underlying...
It's not. It's basically about controlling the news. It's a bit like what's going on with drones, taking the human factor out of warfare. They're taking the human factor out of journalism.
Yes, and it is to do with economics. You're right. And economics determines everything. Journalism, like every other capitalist industry, is determined by the economics.
I don't think it's to do with economics. I think it's
not just to do with economics.
Psychological warfare, effectively.
Well, there's psychological warfare as well, but print journalism is on the out because it's basically been destroyed by the way in which modern technology works. And that is, you know, and then on top of that, you've got all of these intelligence services, corporate bosses and so on. They've got their agenda. They control the old agenda. They control the new agenda because they're the ones who control the agenda.
It's in a little bit Max Headroom, isn't it, this? The idea of having a CGI presenter and the AI, some sort of bot in your processor that's written that day's news.
Well, Max Headroom was very much a product of the 1980s, so you could see that it was a bot. The real problem is that doctoring videos and so on, where you don't know that it is a bot, and that you can actually mimic people's voices and create evidence of all sorts of things. You know, this is the world
we're
moving into.
It's pretty obvious where we're heading, isn't it? That the idea here is that there will no longer be any kind of balanced journalism. There will no longer even be ordinary journalists to tell you the news. A lot of it, of course, is based in London, the national news, and I think this is one of the reasons why we're seeing a bit of pushback from regional news centres, where they're saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, basically we're not going to be here in a few years' time. We're finding that the actual agendas that we're being told to write about, we don't agree with, we don't believe, and so there is some pushback. The idea of taking the human element out of our journalism is actually extremely chilling. There is a fascistic element to it, Martin, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I mean, the word fascism, of course, is overused, but clearly it's about control.
Or should we say totalitarian?
Yeah, okay,
should we say authoritarian?
Yeah.
The idea that journalism is not there to tell the people what's going on. Of course, the parallels with what's happening to Julian Assange should be very apparent.
It is, but don't forget that most journalists throughout most of modern history have been there to big up the corporate sponsors who pay their wages or the governments that they work in for indirectly. The number of investigative journalists who actually investigated the evil by the authority, you can count on one or two hands. Most journalism has actually been propaganda. People who get paid quite good salaries to write every day for the Daily Mail and the Sun.
I don't think
mostly rubbish.
It certainly wasn't always like this. I would suggest that, you know, there was a little bit of messing around by editors and managers in the 60s, 70s and 80s. We saw an enormous step change at the BBC when Victor Rothschild had the director general sacked. That was in 1987, the director general being Alastair Milne, whose son, Seamus Milne, was the director of communications for Jeremy Corbyn. We heard Kath Viner recently, Martin, didn't we, at The Guardian, saying that she would under no circumstances would she be allowing Seamus Milne to have his column back at The Guardian. Why is that?
Well, that's because The Guardian has got its own corporate sponsors. They've got a section of the market that they're trying to dominate, which is what you might call the educated liberals, as Julian Assange has said. And they basically want to police the terms of the debate, and therefore Seamus Milne is not welcome.
Anyway,
but then don't forget, as a private organisation, just like all these other organisations,
they can do what they want. Just like the private TV in places like Venezuela.
No, well, yes, indeed, that's right.
And that's why they've had to have a state-run telesur.
Well, that's right, So what you've got to do, unless you're going to close these people down, you've got to create your own alternative, either by the state creating an alternative, and that is perfectly legitimate, or otherwise it really is just the loudest voice.
Private media can actually play quite an important role in coups, for example, can't it?
Well, it certainly There's a huge effort. I mean, there's over the last 20, 30 years, you had Berezovsky in Russia, you had Maldonado in Brazil, you had Berlusconi in Italy, who were basically big media moguls, who were the wealthiest people in the society, controlled huge chunks of the mass media, and were also politicians. And that is actually becoming a normal.
And weren't the banksters behind them?
Well, of course they borrow money from the banks. Yes,
financing these guys. Basically, they'll say, well, here's a few billion. Go and create yourself a media. I mean, we're sitting in the People's Republic of Stokes Croft here, which is a little bit like a, I hate to say this, I shouldn't tell Chris Chalkley I've said this, but it's a bit like a squat. You know, it's a bit untidy. And it's not certainly one
it's
of these.
It's not a corporate headquarters.
No, it
is.
Definitely isn't. But of course, the money behind this, Martin, the money is from the banksters, and they are actually the people surely responsible for making and breaking these giant media moguls, people like Rupert Murdoch.
Well, when you say banksters, it's a shorthand. These people are the banksters. Berlusconi has got shares in lots of big banks, as well as owning the media. Yeah?
They've got their own private wealth as well.
Well, exactly. So the point is that it's all that these people are the global elite, and they control most mainstream media. I mean, if you go to Italy, you'll see loads of TV stations are pumping out pro-right-wing propaganda day in,
it's
day out.
It's basically pornography pretending to be news.
Well, you could say that. I mean, it looks, from a British point of view, it looks very, you know, very questionable. Lots of teenage girls taking their kit off and then over to the news, which is all about how terrible the left-wing government are, etc.
And that, you mean actually the same girls taking their kit into the news studio in Russia
during the Bezbredel years, there was a very popular TV show where girls with their tops off read the news, and that was very popular, but it was very different from the Soviet era and not necessarily better.
Okay, we're going to move on to do a bit more background now. We're used to looking at Assange too, Black History Month, how from the 1960s Boston in the US it was a plague of gentrification, meant a secret Negro removal program which was rolled out right across the Western world. So we have a look at that. And also the pinch point between East and West. The last year, over a quarter of the population, 2 million people, were out on the streets protesting in Hong Kong. Now the number is zero. With the combination of the national security law and the COVID provisions, what's life like now over in the former British colony? We hear from expat Robert Hansen, who lives there, and also the UN General Assembly. As they close, we hear one of the last speeches from Colonel Gaddafi back in 2009. Such a shame he's not around to make these explosive speeches, and maybe because he was making them is one of the reasons they got rid of him. He talks about US assassins over the last 50 years. And you've heard about the Bay of Pigs and the bringing in the greenback dollar as a reason to get rid of John F. Kennedy. Well, Gaddafi suggests another reason. And we've also heard the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasons, Albert Pike, in the US, set up a plan for wars and revolutions. This time we hear from his correspondent over in Italy, Giuseppe Mazzini, also the IRA, kicking out the British after the First World War. And finally, David Icke, a little look at plagiarism by him, a guy called Brian Desborough. He basically cut and pasted Brian Desborough's work and then published it as a book called The Biggest Secret. Of course, The Biggest Secret was probably that he never wrote it at all. So, Martin, on to the Julian Assange case now. Even though there's been no hearings this week, I think it's very important to keep track. And certainly some people have been commenting that, of course, none of this has been heard in The Guardian. There was some criticism, by the way, this week from Jonathan Cook, saying, why has George Monbiot not really commented, apart from retweeting a couple of things about the Assange case, since it's such an important case? Do you think it's fair to criticise individual journalists like Monbiot for not really having anything to say about this?
Well, Jonathan Cook used to work at The Guardian, so he knows of what he speaks. Monbiot's position is that he does kind of support Assange, but he doesn't see it as a priority, and he tweeted this week that soil loss was more important to him than Julian Assange. That's up to him to say that, but of course, Jonathan Cook was saying in his piece this week was that Monbiot knows exactly how far he can go, and if he wants to carry on having a rather lucrative platform in The Guardian, he's got to stick to what The Guardian wants to say. And if he says more than that, eventually he's got, like Seamus Milne, he ain't going to be required back.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what the editor, Kath Viner, has to say about that, whether she would say, well, actually, George Monbiot can say what he wants.
Well, he can say what he wants, but the point is, if you carry on doing that, eventually your contract will not be renewed, which is exactly what's happened to Seamus Mill.
This is the point, isn't it, with the whole Assange case. If people speak out too much about it, they're worried. So how much of this is real threats to people's careers, like Monbiot's, and how much is it fear, Martin? Because there's a lot of fear.
Well, what happens is, you know, if you've got a mortgage, as we were talking about mortgages earlier, and kids, there's a limit to what you're prepared or not prepared to do, unless you're very, very brave.
Also, what's the point of being a journalist with no audience?
Well, indeed. So, in other words, you've got to, in order to get onto the platforms where you can communicate your ideas, then you've got to make some compromises. It's the same as true in politics, same as true in life. And, of course, there's not actually a right and a wrong answer to what people should do in the face of that sort of pressure.
We're going to listen now to somebody who will not be on The Guardian because Kath Viner is editing it. And his name is Craig Murray. He was our man in the public gallery right the way through this incredible, extraordinary rendition, extraordinary extradition hearing. So this is what Craig Murray had to say last week, the end of last week.
The United States is claiming a universal jurisdiction to swoop down anywhere in the world and destroy the life of anybody who publishes things it does not want revealed. And this ridiculous claim of universal jurisdiction should not be accepted or tolerated for a moment in a British court, let alone granted all the panoply of justice, so-called, which is defending this indefensible situation.
Well, he's picking up the point there of the Americans trying to say that their law applies all over the world. And they've also said, extraordinary enough, Pompeo's on the record of saying this, that the Constitution of the United States guarantees freedom of speech, but only to American citizens. So Assange is simultaneously not an American citizen, therefore not entitled to freedom of speech, but he's also subject to American law, even though he's not an American citizen, and he's not entitled to freedom of speech. That is the Orwellian conclusion that one can draw from this top British court's proceedings.
Well, supposedly top, but this judge, Vanessa Baritza, at Westminster Magistrates Court, there's no jury here. She's deciding on her own, and she's not going to let us know until the new year what she's decided. What's your guess, Martin?
I think they're finding it difficult. Don't forget that the Lady Arbuthnot, who's her boss, her husband is a top MOD Tory politician person, and they make lots of money contracting to the MOD. So there's plenty of conflicts of interest here. I think the problem they're going to have here is that there is no basis in British law for this trial. There just isn't one. It's not even arguable. It shouldn't be occurring at all. And of course, in Spain, the private company which was employed by the CIA via Sheldon Adelson to spy on Assange is actually itself being prosecuted.
So
real courts are starting to get it taken interest.
Well, let's see if Westminster Magistrate is a real court or a corrupt, crooked court. We shall see. Assange, again, was talked about, and this little clip is with two people. One is James Goodale, and the other one is Daniel Ellsberg, we're going to hear from now, talking about the Assange case. Daniel Ellsberg was involved in the Pentagon Papers, I believe, which is a whole load of leaked stuff in the United States. And as he points out, Martin, he's saying that he thought that this had set a precedent in the US, that nothing like what happened to him could happen to anyone, let alone Julian Assange in a foreign country.
Well, that's right. And he says that what he did, because he was a Pentagon insider, and this was in the days before modern technology, he carefully photocopied all of the internal files, which showed that the Pentagon leadership knew that they were losing the war in Vietnam, that it was unwinnable, but they were telling the public, you know, one more big push.
And Congress, of course.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the same sort of thing is going on with the security services here, surely. You know, MI5s, your MI6, the CIA are all cut from the same cloth, aren't they?
Indeed. And, of course, you know, the Ellsberg passed this stuff to the New York Times. They published it. And in the end, the government realised that they couldn't prosecute anybody because the fact was that these were genuine files. There was nothing that was untrue in anything that anybody had said. And that ultimately, it's their responsibility to protect their own secrets. And if you can't protect your own secrets, you can't punish people for telling secrets that you have been unable to protect.
There's the other point, of course, which is that the security services here in the UK and everywhere around the world, they will say, for example, before an important vote over a war or a controversial action of some kind in Parliament, Martin, they will give briefings to MPs, won't they? And those briefings, of course, are private.
Yeah, and of course, what happens is there's an incredible deference towards them, partly simply through people being dumb, but also because people are scared. And they go out of their way to make sure they've got information on everybody who's of any importance, so that if they start making a fuss, then they can be dealt with. That's what they do. They've always been doing it.
I noticed also that Jonathan Evans was promoted to be Director General of MI5 when he did the cover-up for MI5 of the 7/7 London bombings.
Well, that may, of course, he was, and of course they're now, as we know, we've heard in the first part of the show, the government are trying to, and they're probably going to pass with this Tory majority, they're going to pass the law that says that anything they do, however illegal, is justified as long as they think it's justified. Amazing.
And a descent into tyranny of some sort, as was talked about earlier. Anyway, let's have a listen now to James Goodale and Daniel Ellsberg talking about the Assange case.
Everyone should understand that the government has been thirsting for over 50 years to bring this criminal action against those who are performing journalistic functions. 50 years ago, it tried to stop the Times from publication. Lawyers call that a civil case. It thereafter tried to bring a criminal case, very much like the Assange case, in which it was trying to show that Ellsberg conspired with the New York Times reporters to violate the criminal laws of the United States, namely the Espionage Act. Now, they gave up on that case. It disappeared. But now, 50 years later, it's reemerged. What the government wants to prove is that when a reporter tries to get a leak by talking to a leaker, he, as a leakee, can be criminally convicted of a conspiracy for talking to a source. So what's involved here is a criminalization of the basic journalistic function, which is a reporter asks a source for information and thereafter is able to publish it. If that source has classified information and is leaking it, the government is saying they both go to jail. I would say there is one other similarity with the Pentagon Papers case, which turned out to have a lot of hooey in it, which the government made to seem very important, but it wasn't. It was stuff that had already been published in the New York Times. The government does not have a case here, really, against Assange for publishing information that violates national security. The information informed the public he published. It did not damage national security. The government can show no damage to national security in this case, and indeed can show that no individual was damaged by this publication. So keep in mind, this is the other side of the Pentagon Papers case that was never decided, but the information that's involved in it is of no more importance in terms of damage to national security as it was in the first instance.
And the stakes here are such that if the United States can extradite and prosecute Julian Assange or someone like Julian Assange, a foreigner to the United States living abroad, who has revealed true information and true documents, then no journalist in the world wants to publish information like that provided by Chelsea Manning or Ed Snowden is safe from the prospects of life imprisonment in the United States. Thus, this directly affects the interests, not just of the reporters, but the interests they serve, which is the possibility of democracy in various places, which is threatened very much in this country right now. They want to close down, in other words, unauthorized disclosures, meaning that the news we have of what our government is doing in our name, with our tax money, and to other people in the world, is based entirely on government handouts, as it is in some places in the world, like, I take it, China or Stalinist Russia, various places, the end of a republic, essentially, of any kind of public sovereignty. Now, as I follow the tweets on this by Kevin Gostola and Joe Laurie of Consortium News, Craig Murray and some others, following it, I'm forced to relive a trial, my trial, that I had hoped not to have to think about ever again.
So that's Daniel Ellsberg, the leaker of the Pentagon Papers from, 50 years ago, Martin, saying that he'd hoped that this was all dealt with then, but it's all coming back to bite us.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is clearly a push towards a more authoritarian state, both in the US and Britain as an enabling power. But of course, it's actually completely at variance with British legal tradition going back centuries, which is why I'm astonished that we've got to this stage. This should have been thrown out at the very earliest stages, because there isn't any basis in British law, in English common law, for this prosecution.
Well, why didn't, do you think, Julian Assange do a deal with Donald Trump, for his freedom?
Well, the reason why Assange didn't do a deal for his freedom is because that would presume that he'd done something wrong, which he needed to be pardoned.
So he's a principled guy.
Yeah, he's a very principled guy. He certainly is.
And also, of course, as we heard a couple of weeks ago, he was prepared to kill himself with a razor blade rather than face life in prison and torture in the United States.
Yeah, although the psychologist brought in by the government to say that this was all phooey, turns out that his company works very closely with the Ministry of Defence on psychological warfare.
And they knew
the
facts.
Everybody to do with the case from the prosecution side have got massive links with the British military-industrial complex, and they all make money out of it.
Anyway, just about a week after he was taken to hospital with COVID, Donald Trump is out. So let's hear from him and Biden.
Don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it. And now I'm better, and maybe I'm immune. I don't know. But don't let it dominate your lives. Get out there.
I would hope that the president, having gone through what he went through, and I'm glad he seems to be coming along pretty well, would communicate the right lesson to the American people. Masks matter. These masks, they matter. It matters. It saves lives. It prevents the spread of the disease.
So he's saying, get out there, Martin. He's taking a very different attitude to Biden, who's saying masks matter, whatever that means.
Well, I mean, it's become politicized, hasn't it, this whole response to the pandemic?
It's a bit silly, isn't it, really? We should be letting doctors decide these things, not politicians who've got an axe to grind.
Well, the politicians ultimately have to trade off the economy versus the medical side of it.
And that's why the politicians get the final say. We certainly should not be allowing people from the big pharma into positions like chief medical officer and chief scientific officer to make these decisions for the politicians.
Well, these people come to their positions through a process, Tony.
It's called infiltration. That's exactly what the big pharmaceutical industry lobby does.
It's the same with the arms industry.
There's
far too much power for vested interests in the way we run our systems. I'm not denying that. On the other hand, the systems are still there. Maybe we shouldn't participate in elections at all, Tony. Maybe we should just start killing police officers and build a commune right here. Right now, from people.
You want a world revolution?
Well, I'm just saying, if you're going to say we shouldn't have anything to do with the system, that's the logic where you're going.
I'm saying, basically, I mean, as you were saying a couple of weeks ago, that we should have a professional civil service that doesn't allow things like big pharmaceutical company presidents with £600,000 worth of shares to be making decisions.
Yes, can I also mention the group you talked about earlier, the Baratza group or whatever it's called? I sent you an article about this by Nafiz Ahmed.
Yeah, we've already said this.
Yes, but the point is that they have got an axe to grind as well. They've got lots of interest. They're very close to
these
security forces.
These axes, Martin, you've already said this. These axes to grind have got to be kept out of the system. And of course, we can't scrutinise that if we've got this draconian form of journalism we were just hearing about Julian Assange being basically a scapegoat for.
Indeed. And therefore, everybody's voice should be heard. But that doesn't mean that everybody's right or that everybody's got the answer. Okay, in actual fact, everybody is using the appeal to authority.
Yeah, and we heard Vernon Coleman giving you some very good examples of lots of voices that are not being heard. Anyway, we're off to Hong Kong now, and the COVID National Security and the link between COVID and the National Security Act is discussed this week with me by Robert Hansen. And the links between Hong Kong and China, what has been going on over there, I asked him.
anybody flying into Hong Kong has to do 14 days quarantine. So if you came to Hong Kong, Tony, you'd have to do 14 days quarantine. With a cabin crew, what they like to do is they like to get into Hong Kong and then get out of Hong Kong, maybe have one night in a hotel and then get back to the UK or onto their next journey. In this particular instance of the cabin crew, they normally stay at a very nice hotel, a high five-star super luxury hotel. And they were all checked into this hotel for one night and then back to London, hopefully the following day. But in the middle of the night, like 2-3 in the morning, all the medical staff came in with their medical gear, all their masks and all their blue rubber gloves and everything, and then said, one person's tested positive, so you've all now got to go into quarantine. So they were taken from their five-star super luxury hotel to a quarantine center where the room is about 8 feet by about 5 feet and very basic. And so this British Airways staff is not happy because she's young, she's healthy, and she's lost her five-star hotel. She can't go back to England, and she's just literally locked up for 14 days in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong now, after the security bill was put, the first thing, the security bill is called Article 23. Well, it should have gone. There's two ways to pass security law in Hong Kong. One, you can do it in the Hong Kong, the equivalent of the British Parliament, the Hong Kong Parliament, if you, it's called LegCo, the Legislative Council. But they've tried to get that through originally in 2003, didn't get it through, so it was never passed in Hong Kong. The other way you can pass laws in Hong Kong, if mainland China passes the law in mainland China and then says, this belongs to security and you're having this law. And with the national security law, this law was passed in China and forced into Hong Kong and then just signed into law in Hong Kong. So there was no debate in the Hong Kong Parliament about it. It was just stamped, passed, you're having it. And essentially, you're not allowed to criticize the Communist Party in any way. You're not allowed to mention the word separation of Hong Kong from China. That's a breach of the national security law. And for that, you can face life imprisonment. That's how serious it is. If you call for anything to do with Hong Kong independence, Hong Kong separation, you're looking at a life sentence, which is not good. Okay. It's that serious. If you,
you were saying earlier on, you've got a couple of million people out on the streets all saying this last year. Now nobody.
Now nobody. Absolutely nobody. So there's two things about the protests. A, these are the kind of the discussions. Were they organised by external forces trying to disturb China, or was China itself organising the protests in order to justify passing the national security?
Well, I mean, there's another thing, and that is that there may just be genuine fear by ordinary Hong Kong people, and that may contribute it to it too. So which, you know, spread of who's behind them? You know, was it a genuine local movement? Was it the CIA spending money trying to agitate to annoy the Chinese, or the Chinese trying to agitate and control the opposition?
It could have been. I mean, this was a protest that was well organized and well funded. I mean, extremely well organized. And, you know, very well funded. You know, leaflets, banners, all the electronic stuff as well. The way, if you're at the protest, a black van would arrive and it would give out free food for everybody. Really nice food as well. I just passed by a couple of these protests and observed these vans arriving and giving out, you know, high-end Pret a Manger sandwiches and, you know, nice water, nice pop, and to the protesters. So it was organized. It was definitely organized. That's the one thing that is sure about.
And what do you make of the actual virus itself?
I got a printout a while ago of the people that have died of the virus. Most of them are in their 90s, in their 100s. People live a long time in Hong Kong, and in their 80s. And I think there's very, very few under the age of 60 that have died with, not even from, but with this coronavirus in Hong Kong. So I don't think it's that serious. I don't know anyone that's actually had the virus. It seems to me that it's just one hell of a, it's going to be used really to just to control people. You think about what happened in Hong Kong. Was it the national security law that scared people, or was it the virus that scared people? Because they both kind of happened at the same time. Well, the virus came and then the security law was passed virtually at the same time. So the virus helped stop, you know, the protests, stop gathering. And it's been used as a legal excuse to say you can't gather in more than groups of four outside, therefore you can't protest. Very convenient for that. It's very convenient to start vaccinating people. It's very convenient to have a health passport, a digital passport, which I think is coming at 200 miles an hour.
So that's Robert Hanson speaking to me this week from Hong Kong, Martin. He's I found quite fascinating things he was saying there was all the money that seems to be being spent at these protests, like all the nice sandwiches and pop being brought for people, everything very no expense spared for the protests. Now nothing at all.
Well, I mean, the Chinese government has always claimed, and I think rightly, that the protesters are being manipulated by foreign intelligence services.
That's the Americans and the Brits, is it?
Yeah. And that doesn't mean that there aren't legitimate reasons for people to protest. That just means that, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend. And we're going to hear something about the IRA in the First World War there. They were quite happy to take German rifles to fight the British. And, of course...
And by the way, the Israelis, in their very first days, 1947, 1948, were very happy to take Nazi Messerschmitts to have an air force.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, the both can be true. That there are genuine protesters who've got whatever their goals are, and you've also got outside forces egging them on because it causes trouble for the Chinese Communist Party. Just as the Chinese Communist Party, for example, supported the Zimbabwean African National Liberation Army in Zimbabwe many years ago because they wanted to, you know, basically mess with the West.
But I was quite interested to talk to Robert about, well, he was very much volunteering the information. Fascinating to hear about the Rockefellers and the secret societies that operate in Hong Kong and China.
One of the big players in China is the Rockefeller Institute, the Rockefeller Foundation. That's massive. It's been in China since the days of Chairman Mao, and even worked with Chairman Mao. And it's extremely influential in the financial sector, and it's extremely influential in promoting the global warming scam. Indeed, some of the Rockefeller family come across to Hong Kong to actually give talks on the global warming scam and have written children's books on it. So, yeah, the Rockefellers are extremely influential in China. Who's doing this? You know, my mind switches between the two. I'm not sure. Is it the mainland doing it on purpose to do this? Or is it America doing it? Or is it, you know, really what you've got is you've got this serious group of serious world leaders, the real people that run the world, who are... But some are Chinese, some are British, some are American, some are German, and they're the real controllers of the whole thing.
Isn't it? I mean, you've got secret societies, you know, the famous triads. I don't know if they're still around. But they're
still around, actually. There was a stabbing in a bar last night, a triad, and somebody was murdered. So the triads still exist in Hong Kong.
Because I'm thinking, because you've got the triads in China and Hong Kong, you've got the Masons over in the United States, and you've got people like Henry Kissinger.
The Masons are certainly very active in Hong Kong, and I know that for sure. And I know that, I know that is, and they're very heavily involved in the legal sector.
Okay, Robert Hanson again, Martin. Interesting that he's one of the fascinating things about Robert, I think he's got a similar perspective to me, is he's always trying to work out where the power actually lies. He's saying, well, he's not even sure that this is really a fight between China and the United States going on in Hong Kong, or China and Britain, that actually there's a third force, a bigger force, a more powerful force that is using Hong Kong just as a cat's paw.
Well, I mean, I have to say I'm basically a traditional international relations person, and I think that there is fundamental differences in the interests of different elites, and that they're not all in the same.
I don't think he's saying they're all in the same boat, but he's saying that there is a contingent of super elites, if you want, who actually like to play one side off against the other and find it rather entertaining and get power from it.
Well, Kissinger's a rapprochement with China in order to isolate the Soviet Union was the major power play by the US elites in the 1970s, just as taking the dollar off gold was part of the same Nixon administration strategy.
But you can't talk about Hong Kong and China without thinking about the massive influence that China has, say, for example, here, at the possibility of building the Hinkley Power Station and other things. We were talking mm-hmm. to Ian Robinson earlier about the deep water port that is supposed to be being financed at Avonmouth by the Chinese. And he had some fascinating, I thought anyway, revelations about Chinese control and Hong Kong control of British utilities. Now, these are the things that were privatised by Margaret Thatcher back in the 1980s, the water, gas, electricity, telecoms, etc., the things that we all need to survive, the basic infrastructure of society, the things that we definitely need. And these are the kinds of people who don't actually, they're not entrepreneurs, they're just parasites. But anyway, he had quite an interesting angle on that because of what he thinks is an enormous amount of Chinese money involved in running British utilities right now. So why is it, I tell you, before we hear this, Martin, why is it we're hoo-haing about Huawei when actually the Chinese are owning many of our utilities?
Well, the fact is that the Chinese economy has become integrated into the global capitalist economy. Although, interestingly enough, what's happening now as a result of the recent events is that the Chinese are now moving towards looking at to boost their own domestic demand rather than being totally reliant on exports. And in actual fact, the Chinese economy is only about 15% dependent on exports. Most of what they do is actually within China itself.
Are the Western powers also thinking that, well, this financial interest that the Chinese have got in the West, maybe we'll just cut them off and maybe they'll get nothing back?
Well, indeed, they hold the US national debt. But they're mugs to hold the US national debt because the US have got no intention of paying it. So what they're now deciding is that they're going to have to develop their own resources because all the sanctions, which the WTO, in fact, have decided are unfair under the existing rules, they're now going to have to move to a more autarkic policy within China.
What does that mean?
Autarky is when you actually have a complete, you're like North Korea, where you run your own show your own way and you don't have any foreign influence. And of course the same thing happened with the sanctions on Russia after the Crimea incident. The Russians were then forced to actually redirect their resources to their own internal resources and to people who are more reliable for them. So both China and Russia.
It's a bit like Britain before exchange controls.
Yes, but they're much bigger. China and Russia are big enough, if they're pushed out of the mainstream system by the West, and that seems to be the way things are going.
What I'm trying to do is pull this down to talking about here in the UK, because it's all very easy to think about this in far away, but Britain was basically running its economy to benefit its own population up until exchange controls. Then all sorts of other companies could come in and buy up, as I'm just saying here, these Chinese utilities.
Well, the British economy was, as always, that we were the dominant hegemonic power until World War One. And at that, and that's how, we didn't just run the British economy to suit the British. We ran the British economy and everybody else's economy to suit the British.
Anyway, final clip from Robert Hanson here is about the influence of Hong Kong and Chinese utilities and a specific individual on the British utilities.
If you look at products now, they have to come with an energy rating certificate, EPC, energy performance certificate. Even if you want to sell a house, you've got to have an EPC. Every product is graded up to like A to G. And with a smart meter, you'll be able to tell, is this product an A, B, C, D, E, F, or G? And if it's not the right one, sorry, mate, you're going to have to change it. And if you're using too much, essentially, it gives the other people, the people who run the system, the power to control what's going on in your house. And I think that is fundamentally wrong.
Okay. To what evidence is there that Chinese banks and businesses are buying up British utilities then?
Okay. I just got a print out here of. In terms of the energy companies, we'll do energy and water, just do two very quickly. SGN actually is actually mainly owned by a company in Abu Dhabi, that's one there. Northern Gas Networks is Hong Kong, essentially owned by Lee Kar Sing. That's a Hong Kong company, but he's very close to China. Cadent Electricity is owned by Qatar Investment. Wales and West Utility is 100% owned by Hong Kong. That's Lee Kar Sing's Chern Kong Group. SP Energy is owned by a Spanish group. UKPN, again, is owned by or 40% in that is owned by Cheung Kong again, and Northern Power Grid is owned by Berkshire Hathaway. That's
so what is, I mean, it does strike me as it's strange. What is the point in our telecom network being Huawei being removed from that when you've got these Chinese and Hong Kong owned companies controlling much of our utilities? Obviously, if they're owned, they control the shareholders, they control the board, that sort of thing, then they could just put their people in to run these places.
Which is what they will do. And the real power is with the people that own the company. I'll just give you a few more of those and come back to you. Cambridge Water, again, is owned by Lee Kar Sing from Hong Kong. Essex and Suffolk Water, again, is owned by Lee Kar Sing from Hong Kong. Northumbrian Water is owned by Lee Kar Sing from Hong Kong. And
okay, who is this guy? Lee Kar Sing.
Whoa. Lee Kar Sing is one of the wealthiest men in the world. There was an interesting article in the South China Morning Post about 5 years ago. I cut it out. I wanted the paper copy because I know it's going to be removed from the internet. And they published it twice. And it said this: Lee Kar Sing owns his fortune not due to his great entrepreneurial skills, but due to the close relationship he had with the mainland Chinese government, which gave him preferential land at preferential prices. And that is how he's made his fortune. So my point is that if the government or the mainland China is giving him all these special deals, they've got a control over this guy. He's the front man. He's the Bill Gates of the vaccine world. He's the front man of this. And through him and through Hong Kong, which is supposed to be the good guy, China's supposed to be the bad guy. I'm saying there ain't any difference, folks. Wake up. This guy's going and buying up all the utilities on behalf of China. And when you've got them one by one, bit by bit, you are in full control of the important things that people need, the really, really important things. We need electricity. We need water. We need gas. We need telecoms. And these are the things, the important things that they're buying up and they are controlling.
Haven't we made a bit of a strategic mistake? Interesting to hear that our own Wales and West utilities owned by this guy, Lee Kar Sing, from Hong Kong, the guy who's actually based in Hong Kong, but actually his real loyalty is to mainland China. Haven't we rather messed up by handing all these essential public services over to China?
Well, we shouldn't have privatised them at all. That's the obvious point to make. And of course, Lee Kar Sing was a big contributor to Conservative Party funds for many years, when Mark Thatcher was still persona grata, before he was convicted of trying to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea in South Africa. He boned up Lee Kar Sing and said, "It's time to pay up for Mumsy." And Lee Kar Sing gave money to the Conservative Party.
It's almost like organised crime, isn't it? Look,
well, it is like organised crime.
Week,
it is organised crime,
this
isn't it?
This week in the Telegraph, Three seizes on the 5G boom as mobile mast sale renews merger talk. The Hong Kong-owned firm is considering selling some of its mobile network infrastructure to raise billions of pounds as demand for 5G grows. The mobile operator Three exploring a sale of its masts in a bid to cash in on the shift to 5G networks. So this is Lee Kar Sing in the telecoms business. I imagine it's quite a Huawei kit in his mask, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point is, if you're going to integrate China into the global capitalist economy, which everybody thought would be a great idea, then inevitably they're going to end up owning stuff. And of course, what they've got in China is you can't own anything more than 49%. So anybody investing in China has to give a controlling stake to the Chinese partner, often local governments. Now, one of the pressure things that Trump is pushing them to do is to change that, so that, you know, you could have majority-owned Western businesses operating in China. The Chinese are, for very good reason, in my view, not very pleased to do that, but I think it's the sort of thing they're prepared to do to try and get a deal with the Americans over trade. But increasingly, there's a very good article about this on the Saker this week. The Chinese are concluding that there's no real deals to be done with the West, and that as the Russians have known for years, that ultimately they're going to have to face them down. And of course, the fact that what will happen is that the stuff that they control in this country will simply be seized. But of course, if that happens, all Apple's investments in China will be seized. So we'll have to see who wins in that game.
Well, that, I imagine, is going to be more of a step towards a shooting war of some sort.
Well, indeed, the shooting war has already started in certain parts of the world, in case anybody hadn't noticed.
Places like North Ossetia and Nagorno-Karabakh. We've got various tension points around the world.
Yeah.
Also, I think something you pointed out to me after the show last week, Martin, is about election observers as well. That, I think, is quite an important topic, isn't it? Because all the controversy over the Venezuela election and the Belarus elections, apparently they weren't the election observers that they normally are. They usually have people from the OECD or the UN observing these elections.
Not the UN. The UN would have been prepared to send people. It's the EU that won't send election observers to the
election. I mean, surely if there were election observers, they could just say, well, that was okay. That
that's why they don't send them. Yeah, that's why that's why the OSCE.
So they don't want to know whether an election is actually
no. Because if you're going to claim that Maduro and Lukashenko have lost the election, the last thing you need is independent observers on the ground saying, "Well, hang on a minute, it looks like he's won."
So this is the OECD, the European Union, this time.
No, the OECD is actually not the OECD. It's the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
Right. Okay. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, and they basically are the same. Similar things happen with the Organization for Prevention of Chemical Weapons. They have been captured by Western interests. So what happened in the UN this week, the former head of the Organization for Prevention of Chemical Weapons said that what had happened at Douma, where there was supposedly a chemical weapons attack by the Syrian army, was a fraud, and that the investigators on the ground testified that it was actually carried out by the jihadis who were supported by the West, by MI6 and the CIA. So they were the ones who actually carried out the attack. But at the same time, the OPCW has been captured by, and the Russians are very clear about this, it's now been captured by the West, so that they then come out with fraudulent findings. And they've also come out with a fraudulent finding about Navalny, supposedly being poisoned by Novichok from a plastic water bottle, which didn't kill anybody else who touched it, extraordinarily enough. But anyway, leaving aside all of the illogicalities in that, we're moving to a situation where the West is, unless it can control international organisations like the International Criminal Court, the courts that deal with the law of the sea, Organisation of the Prevention of Chemical Warfare, the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe, they either control them or they sabotage them. And of course they're using both mechanisms to try and basically get their way. And of course the main target of all this manipulation is the population in their own countries, so that they go along with all of this.
Briefly looking at antiwar.com and back to Trump, Martin, he says he's going to be out of Afghanistan by Christmas. I think it's well worth watching everything that Trump is saying in this election campaign to do with his foreign policy. He made a big thing in his first election 5 years ago that he was going to pull out of these foreign wars. At least he certainly wasn't going to start any. So we need to make sure, I think, keep quite a close eye on Trump. If he doesn't say that this time, there's probably a war coming, isn't there?
Well, Trump can say that because he's trying to say what he thinks will get him re-elected. Whether he's got the power to do anything he wants to do is another matter, because he's not necessarily in charge. But let's not forget that he assassinated Soleimani at the beginning of the year, which nearly started World War III just on its own. That was an act of war.
Well, I think the Iranians made sure that that wasn't ever going to happen.
Well, what they did is they missiled the American base, and the Americans didn't dare punch back. But that came very, very close. If the Americans had punched back, we wouldn't be talking about COVID. We'd be talking about all this other stuff.
Now, so for Black History Month, always like to do something a bit different. Last year, I did something about the black legend, which is this whole idea that there was some sort of Halcyon thing going on in places like South America when Christianity arrived, which was just simply not true. This week, I thought we'd have a look at something much more up to date, which is in the 1960s and 1970s, the planning policy in US cities after the American economy started to tank and they realised that there wasn't going to be income for these cities. They decided to change the way they do things. I think we've seen something similar going on in this country, Martin, where basically the local authorities are not satisfied with people on low incomes paying small amounts of rent, even for public housing. They want to make sure that large amounts of money in that city is being paid for rent so they can take their cut. Do you think that's been going on over here too?
Well, gentrification is and the manipulation of property markets has been going on for a very long time. But of course, as you know, after the Second World War in this country, you could have areas of London, for example, where council housing was cheap by jowl with relatively prosperous private housing.
But the actual amount was
using the planning laws to create mixed communities.
The amount people were paying on rent was absolutely, you know, very, very, very low compared to their annual salary compared to today. And that's what really this clip is about. The guy giving the talk here is Lyndon LaRouche, who died last year. Do you want to say something about him? Because he's quite a controversial character, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a controversial character. He claims to be part of the Democratic Party tradition, although they've always disowned him. He's got quite radical views about various things, but he did
before he died.
You better hear what he's got to say. Sometimes he talks sense, and sometimes he's away with the fairies.
Let's have a listen to Lyndon LaRouche here talking about the Negro removal program in Boston and elsewhere in the United States in the 1960s and 70s.
When the United States was transformed from an industrial economy to a post-industrial economy. In the middle of the 1966-68 period, everything began to be turned around. As you know from many of you who are close to my generation and some younger, know that there was a change in the U.S. economy where suddenly everything began to go bad. We began to become a post-industrial society, and there was no flow of investment or a constricted flow of investment into anything that resembled real production, particularly from 1973-74, investment in productive industry, energy-intensive forms, capital-intensive forms dried out. Businesses, industries began to collapse. Employment began to collapse. The whole business. And then after the effect of deregulation of transportation in 1978, and then the Folkland Measure 79 through 1982-83 especially, the entire economy went dead. Now, what happened is then you find an immediate collapse of the tax revenue base of state and local government. So now you have a city like Boston, and you say, okay, where are you going to get the money to meet the tax rolls for the city of Boston and for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? Because the industries like the Quincy Shipyards, the Navy Yard down there in Charlestown Navy Yard and so forth, all these industries, GE used to have 30,000 employees in the area. They went down to who knows what. Whole industries disappeared. Where's the tax revenue base? 128 began to shrink. Where's the tax revenue base? Well, what the city of Boston said, what the bankers said, the big insurance cartels that controlled Massachusetts, said to an organization called the Vault, which is operating on State Street, which involved the investment in government and other swindles by this crowd. They said, okay, the municipality of Boston, Greater Boston, has so many square miles of territory. Now, therefore, for Boston to get a tax revenue base, maintain it, we must get so many dollars in tax revenue per square foot of area. Now, we have no industries to get it from. We don't have any productive employment. So what do we have to do? We have to pull a real estate swindle. All right. We have to get real estate people to invest, increase the tax rate by giving them tax exemptions to get the gross tax base increased. Now that means we've got to swindle the people. Mm-hmm. So what you do where people have a $30,000 investment or a $40,000 investment represented in a home they may own or the equivalent apartment, kick them out. Gentrify the apartment. That started back in the 1960s with the older people in Boston. There were older people, semi-retired, who had fairly large family-style homes. They were kicked out and they began moving college kids in. You know, 20 to the room, right? And high rents. So they began to kick out the traditional residents of neighborhoods and do this. Then they went to real estate speculation. And Nancy Spanos knows a good deal about that sort of stuff because she and her later husband did a lot of work in New York on this study, right? So what they did then is they would say, okay, we'll let the real estate sharks steal so much and we'll take a small percentage of it. So the entire federal, state, local housing policy of government of the country was steered in this direction. This became a policy known as Negro removal. Right. Kick people out of the community, throw them into a worse slum, throw them out of the slums, and throw them into the countryside. That's how we got the big homeless problem in many of our cities.
Well, that's not a bad summary of what happened with the decisions that were made in that era to get from what was an industrial economy with strong trade unions and government intervention to ensure level playing fields in things like housing, to where we are now, where, you know, we're building the massive monstrosity near Castle Park in Bristol, which no local person will be able to afford any kind of flat in there. They'll all be people from abroad who are basically money laundering. I bet it'll be very interesting to see how many people actually live there and are registered to pay council tax. Because in some of these big apartment blocks in London that have been built, mostly for foreigners, hardly anybody is registered there for council.
But it's
tax.
An interesting angle, isn't it, on the relationship between developers and government, in that actually this is good for the developers, and it's good for the government. The developers make a load of money. The government, local government or national government, increase their tax revenue by gentrification.
No, what actually happens is they get a small cut of the swindle, as he pointed out.
Okay.
If they got more of a cut, then there might be a justification for it. You say, right, we're going to build these luxury homes, but we're going to tax them a lot so that we can afford to pay
and
the social services.
Linda
but
LaRouche.
That isn't the case of what they've done.
That was Linda
it's
LaRouche.
It's just swindle, pure and simple.
From the LaRouche organisation who died last year. They're still around, though. I think it's called Executive Intelligence Review, their regular publication. And so our penultimate item tonight, Martin, is about the IRA and American help for them. Another LaRouche person here. And this, I believe, is Anton Chaykin talking about the early days of the IRA and the help that the Irish had in overthrowing the British Empire from the States. A chap called Henry Carey and Horton Barker and Arthur Griffiths.
Another person you never heard of, Horton Barker. He was a central figure in the project from here on out. This is a Carey insider in Philadelphia. It was at his house that the dignitaries from these other countries met when they came to the centennial. And just like they might come into Leesburg today, all right, to talk about what they're going to do. In 1878, he was hired by the Russian Tsar to build ships for the Russian Navy in the Philadelphia shipyard, warships. He then went to South Russia to supervise the industrialization of South Russia, or to plan that, with Bethlehem Steel, which was owned by his uncle, Joseph Wharton. He also supervised the Ireland Revolution unit of the Carey people. That is, Irish people in America and Ireland, working together with this little circle of people, set up something called the Clan na Gael. And one of their central people went from Philadelphia to Ireland in 1878 and organized 20,000 feuding Irishmen into a central revolutionary organization called the Irish Revolutionary Brotherhood. And together with their Clan na Gael in the United States, which shipped arms and money to Ireland, that continued to be the main organization of Irish nationalism until Michael Collins and Arthur Griffiths, who worked for that organization, established the nation of Ireland right after World War I.
Well, Martin, it's interesting, isn't it, that the Americans were shipping over the arms for the Irish to kick the British out at the time of the First World War.
Well, it's well known that the Irish connection with America goes back to the famine and before. And of course, you know, it's still got valency, of course, in things like the Brexit talks with the congressional caucuses, both the Republicans and the Democrats, saying any deal they do will have to be consistent with the Good Friday Agreement.
So who were these Clan na Gael people?
Clan na Gael was set up in the 19th century because, of course, the Fenians organised an uprising in the 1860s. That failed. Lots of them fled to the United States. Some of them were transported to Australia. And in the United States, they generally tended to be supporters of the Union, so they fought on the Union side. There was an attempted invasion of Canada from the United States by Irish Republicans who were based in the US after the American Civil War. It didn't get very far. And of course, it wasn't the Irish Revolutionary Brotherhood, it was the Irish Republican Brotherhood. It was called the IRB, which both Collins and Griffiths were part of. And of course, that led to the founding of the IRA, which then led the uprising in 1916.
I mean, they were fleeing to the United States from Ireland, but actually, there were a lot of people forced out during the famines to the US at the same time.
Yeah, that was earlier. That was in the 1840s. We're talking about the 1860s with the Fenian Uprising. And that was basically, you know, a dry run for what subsequently happened. In the 1900s.
Okay, well, we'll skip over Mazzini and Gaddafi. We'll have some from them next week. Both fascinating little interviews, but we'll do that next week. We'll finish this week with David Icke, Martin. Now, you know, some would say he's dodgy and dangerous. I've kind of changed my view about David Icke. I think he's particularly pernicious. Rather than sort of congratulating him for, you know, the idea of him having free speech, and of course I do still agree with him having the right to discredit himself whenever he wishes. For example, he said, and we had it on this program back in April, beginning of April, that he's actually said that he doesn't, well, he's not saying that he doesn't believe COVID-19. He's stating it as a fact. There is no COVID-19. COVID-19 doesn't exist.
Well, he's not noted for the temperance of his views. And everybody's entitled to their views, whatever they are. But of course, they've also got to be able to justify them. And ultimately, of course, if you can't, then you can't.
And this is a little clip from a documentary by Chris White called David Icke Debunked, which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I found it quite strange. I put into David Icke Debunked into the YouTube search. This video didn't come up at all for some reason. And I put it into another search engine's video search, and up it came straight away on YouTube. So YouTube doesn't seem to want to find this unless it's my account, which is massaged in that way. Who knows? But anyway, they're up to no good. They're certainly trying to stop people from seeing this stuff over at Google. But anyway, here is Chris White's, a clip from Chris White's documentary where he cites a guy called Ivan Fraser, who worked up until 1999 very closely with Icke himself, and then realised that Icke was actually stealing stuff and plagiarising material, particularly from this guy in this book, The Biggest Secret, from 1999, from a guy called Brian Desborough. So here is a bit of Ivan Fraser's story of his encounter with Icke, working closely with Icke in 1999, as told by Chris White.
Icke's book, The Biggest Secret, is the first time that I know of that Icke mentions Desborough in print. He dedicated that particular book to him, and he cites him profusely throughout the book as his source for things like Martians coming to Earth and founding the Aryan race, which the reptilians used to overtake the planet. Brian is also the source for much of the information on the Babylonian world, and things like black people are a result of the Earth being closer to the sun at one point, the Ice Age being an illusion, monoatomic gold, directed energy weapons, UFOs are government craft, crop circles are space beams, David's new view on Jesus, and much more. Ivan Fraser, the other person who David dedicated his book, The Biggest Secret, to, later spoke out against David and said this about Brian Desborough, quote, "Is there anything David could tell us about Brian Desborough's background to allay any doubts we may have about his integrity, considering his massive influence in the content and direction of The Biggest Secret? Also, Icke's subsequent book called Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster is no better than a copy and pasting of Brian Desborough's article entitled The 9/11 Disaster, The Myth and Reality. If you have read Icke's Alice in Wonderland book on 9/11, please read Desborough's article when you have time, and you will see that the information in there is exactly the same, the wording, even the mistakes. But the curious thing is that even though it's clear from reading Desborough's 9/11 article that Desborough is the one who did all the research, Icke doesn't cite Desborough one time in his book, even though it's painfully obvious that it was taken from him. I think that Desborough was quite content to feed information to Icke, even if he got no credit. One example of this is in regard to the reptilian scandal. As I mentioned, The Biggest Secret is dedicated to Brian Desborough and another man named Ivan Fraser. According to Fraser, it was Desborough that introduced Icke to Arizona Wilder, and it was her testimony that ended up being the reason why Icke went public with the reptilians thing. Desborough also admits to introducing Ike to Arizona Wilder, as well as arranging the meeting between the two, because Wilder was a victim of trauma-based mind control, and apparently Desborough had accessed her programming in order to get information about the Illuminati. According to him, he was amazed to find that she confirmed what he had already been telling Ike, which will be important later. This is Ivan Frazier's side of the story. He had been proofreading The Biggest Secret for David Icke, and he found out about the reptilians thing this way. He says, quote, "Arizona Wilder was not mentioned at all in the draft copy of The Biggest Secret, which I had read. David had not met her yet. When the book was released, people started ringing me with questions like, 'Is it true about the reptiles?' and 'Is this stuff about the royal family true?' At which time I replied that I thought it was, based on the fact that the version that I had read stated only the theory of reptilians and that certain of the royals were involved in satanic rituals. Soon, I heard about Arizona Wilder. David stated that he saw his encounter with Arizona Wilder as an amazing synchronicity which endorsed his work in his latest book. How could she have known all this stuff which tallied so exactly with The Biggest Secret? Well, I believe I'm not as naive as David, and I know exactly how she could have known. Ike was passing copies of the book via post to me and others for editing." Frazier continues, "This brings in another character who is pivotal to the entire Biggest Secret thesis. It was a contact of David's named Brian Desborough, who introduced Arizona to David. Brian is mentioned as a source for a great deal of the information in the book, having supplied most of the material on which David based his idea about the Martians coming to Earth and founding the Aryan race, which the reptilians use as a vehicle to overtake the planet. Brian is also the source for much of the information David had compiled on the Babylonian world, its myths, and how they fed into the sinister secret societies. It was Brian Desborough who was also looking at the draft copy of The Biggest Secret at the same time as myself, i.e. before David met Arizona Wilder. Therefore, the fact that Brian Desborough may be responsible for fundamentally leading the direction of David's research, if not planting much of the basis of the book in David's mind, is obvious. But then, to be the same person responsible for giving him the so-called eyewitness to testify to the verity of that information is highly suspicious. Brian also writes articles on mind control and seems very knowledgeable on the subject. Is it possible that he could be directly involved in some way that we are not being told about?" Frazier also says that Arizona endorsed Desborough's theories so closely that, quote, "you would almost think she had already read the book or had been given the information beforehand."
So that was Chris White there as part of his David Icke debunked documentary, which is about 2.5 hours long. I think we'll spare you most of that. But I'll put a link up for anyone that's interested on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I suppose the long and short of the documentary, Martin, is that various of his so-called friends are playing David Icke like a fiddle.
Well, it sounds to me as if they're arguing about who actually exposed the reptilian Martian conspiracy. And Ike claims that he thought of it first. And this guy seems to claim, no, I thought of it first, or Brian Desborough thought of it first. But since what I actually fear about all of these is, as a political conspiracy theorist, we want to talk about 9/11. Then we'd have to talk about Piazza Fontana. We have to talk about the IRA and Plan Nagel and things like that.
Well, Ike's 9/11 book, yes, which is Alice in Wonderland.
Well, but the problem with all of this is it then makes everybody think that when we talk about 9/11, we're talking about aliens and Martians.
Well, that's absolute nonsense.
No, of course
it is.
That's
why we're talking about
it. And it may well be that Ike and others like him are actually controlled opposition to make it impossible for us to talk seriously about serious political conspiracies like blowing up the Twin Towers, which wasn't done by Martians, it was done by the US security forces. And of course, just like Clan na Gael or the Irish Republican Brotherhood, maybe we need to talk about weaponry to fight them rather than publishing books and arguing about a lot of nonsense.
Well, you're right, it is nonsense. I'm rather interested in what's happened to Ivan Frazier, though. I certainly see he was on the John Ronson programme, I think it was around 1999, and he was particularly astute as someone who was working closely with Ike and then decided to turn against Ike, turn the tables on him and expose him. But he seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth, Martin.
Listen, I wonder whether all of these people who
Ivan, I think, was a very honest guy who thought that there were some positive things about what Ike was doing. Then he discovered the deception.
I'm willing to listen to anybody's point of view, but my point of view is the point of view that counter gangs are created as a normal part of psychological warfare, as we read in Kitson, Gangs and Counter Gangs, written after the Kenyan emergency in the 1950s.
One of the main thrusts.
So one of the things the state does is create false narratives of conspiracy, so that when we actually start talking seriously about serious conspiracies, the normal population are inoculated against listening to it because they've basically been told all sorts of nonsense about it by people who are possibly paid agents of the state.
The author of Secrets and Lies and the History of Organized Crime, David Southwell, tweeted controlled opposition about David Icke.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think people can be controlled opposition even if they think they're being genuine. But some people aren't even thinking they're being genuine. They're genuinely controlled opposition.
What do you make of the allusions in, I mean, throughout that documentary, he's talking about actually David Icke being a closet theosophist, following the teachings of Alice Bailey, doing things like saying, well, the Earth is going to be transformed by these beams of light from the centre of the solar system, which are reflected through the sun onto the Earth, this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, the purpose of all of this is that when you and I, for example, start talking about Clan na Gael, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, blowing things up, the Dublin and Monaghan bombs of 1972, and the role of the Ghanaian gang, for example, to say, but you just believe that aliens did it all. And they, of course, we don't believe that, but they do. So they put 9/11 in there, which is a serious conspiracy, and then they put all this other stuff in as well. And at one stage in the 9/11 truth movement, I used to be a hippie. I'm perfectly happy to chat about all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas. But there's a big distinction between having a stoned conversation after dinner and organising an armed revolution.
I suppose it's all
not the same thing at all.
It's all to do with the difference between fact and speculation, something that we try and separate as much as possible here. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Martin Summers, Irish Republican Labour activist. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s. You can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. It's also on my Public Inquiry YouTube channel. If you want to comment, you can do as well as you can on thisweek.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Paranoia, can't stop the rock. Shake my paranoia, can't stop the rock. to the groovy.
Oh, come on.